Church. Glad you guys are here with us. If I haven't met you, my name is Mitchell, and I'm a lead pastor here at Antioch. Thanks for coming. As Larry shared, if you are new around here, stop by the Next Steps area on your way out. Another gift we'd love to give you, and just shake your hand and say hi. Also, if you are a guest or newer here, we have about every 6 weeks or so this thing called Intro to Antioch, which is just a little 20, 30-minute meeting for those of you that want to hear more about our history, where we came from, our vision, our values, our doctrine. It's also a space to ask questions to our pastoral staff. So if you have never been to one of these, I want to highly encourage you, if you're trying to discern if this is the church home for you, then that is next Sunday, December 15th, right in between services. So if you want to come again, 10:45, just come a little bit early. We'll probably get started around 10:15, 10:20, and again, it'll last about 20 minutes. So Intro to Antioch. And also, you get to hear a little bit about the Antioch movement that we're a part of, if that is new for you. Antioch is part of a larger network of churches. There's about 50 Antiochs in the U.S., and then about 100 teams overseas. We're just committed to the Great Commission. And this morning, we're in for a treat. Someone within the Antioch family is here to preach this morning. We'll holler for him in just a second. His name's Carl. And this earliest service was a home run. Get ready, guys. You're in for a treat as we're kicking off this Advent series and talking about these different words and leaning into hope a little bit more. But Carl's here with his family. I'll let him introduce his family. But he is a pastor and elder of the Antioch in Waco. And also is the, what's the title, Director of U.S. Churches? Yeah, I nailed it. Yeah. So he helps oversee the U.S. churches, mainly working with the lead pastors, just helping us stay in line, but also encouraging us and coaching us and being a support and a resource for us. And it's been a huge blessing. Known Carl for probably a little over 10 years. Back when I was a college pastor, we were running in college ministry lane. But such a man of God, faithful man of God. And it's going to be a blessing to have him share this morning. You guys ready? All right, help me welcome Carl Gully. Pray for you again. Please do. Yeah. All right, Lord, we thank you. Pray with me. God, we thank you for Carl, and we thank you for the words you've given him. And Lord, I just ask for us to receive what you have, Lord. What do you want to do in us? Help our hearts be open. And God, would you anoint our brother to share with joy? In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks, bro, for wearing blue and gray pants and a white shirt. Really appreciate the welcome and modeling for me what I should wear when I come to your church. And, I do. I already love this family. It's wild seeing different faces of people that I know. I am from Waco, been there my whole life, and so grateful to have my wife, Blair. I've been married to you for 26 years, who's here on the front row. And then to the very end here is my daughter, Mackenzie. Mac, come on up here. Everybody needs to see Mac. Everybody say hi, Mac. Now, she's really already accepted to Baylor and going there, but we had to tour U of A to just make sure we've done that, okay? And so, anyway, so we brought a few of our Waco friends here who go to Arkansas. Maybe they'll sell her on Arkansas. We'll see. Not sure that's going to happen, but, hey, hog's going to hog, right? All right, so, well, now that you're all comfy and cozy and all settled in, why don't we all stand together for the reading of Scripture, okay? We're going to do is we're going to read this scripture. We're going to all read it out loud. If you're a church person, you've heard this verse before. If you're a Christmas freak, you've definitely heard this verse before. And since we're talking about hope, I want you to count how many times you see the word hope in this verse. Are y'all ready? All right, let's read it together. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6 and 7. Let's go. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness, from this time forth and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. How many times do y'all count the word hope was used? I heard two. Oh, I didn't see it. Okay. What'd you say? Zero. Beth doesn't have a voice, so I thought I'd call on her. Zero. Everybody take a seat. Take a seat. Yeah, the word hope is actually not in this passage, which is weird if that's what we're talking about today, to actually not see that word in this passage, but it is actually laced all within that passage. And while we're not going to tear apart this verse, this passage verse by verse, We're going to do something a little different, because when we typically talk about hope, I could stand up here and I could give you the three H's of hope, you know, and we could be really easy to take notes. What I found is that if you're in a hopeless situation or you want to talk about hope, that people, we start tending to try to go, okay, what is hope? How do I find hope? And the more you go banging on the door for hope, actually the less you find it. However, if you'll go backwards and track the faithfulness of God, you actually find it. But you got to go back in history to do that. So we're going to do a little history. We're going to go back and we're going to go looking for the faithfulness of God. Now, speaking of history, you're going to learn in the moments to come. I'm kind of obsessed with it, number one. And number two, I bet some of you are as well, because there's this kind of craze that's been going on in our world the last 10 years called Ancestry.com, where everybody goes back to find out if they're related to anybody cool. Has anybody here related to someone famous? You are. Who are you related to? George W. Bush. That's very famous. Wow. Wow, that's amazing. We got anybody else related to someone famous in the room? Okay. John Wayne. Wow, I don't even need to talk anymore. That you win. You win. So I'm related to William Barrett Travis. Oh my gosh. The Welches have screwed this church up. Nobody even knows who that is. That's embarrassing. Like, I'm from Texas. My mom is from San Antonio, which means I went to the Alamo about 5,000 times, okay? The leader of the Alamo was Lieutenant Colonel William Barrett Travis, okay? In their home hung this amazing letter that he wrote, knowing he was outnumbered by the enemy, and he wrote this letter begging for reinforcements, and the letter basically said, please send reinforcements, but if you do not, I will not surrender, we will not retreat, and then he signed it, victory or death. I mean, we could do ministry time just off that letter. It was so amazing that now, I've actually got a copy of that as well. So you can imagine, I'm dating this girl named Blair. It's getting serious. And so I tell her, if you're going to come into this family, you need to know you're entering into the family line of William Barrett Travis. And much like you Arkansans, is that what you say? You Arkansans, she looked at me blankly and was like, who is that? And I was like, God, do I marry her? Do I not? You know? And I was just like, babe, every kid in seventh grade studied this in Texas history. To which she responded, Carl, I'm from Georgia. We did not take Texas history. And I'm not kidding. That was the first time in my life it dawned on me that everybody was not studying Texas history in seventh grade. Kind of shows the way we Texans think. And I was like, did y'all just take history? Y'all just took that year off? And she said, no, Georgia history is American history. We studied American history. And I literally looked at her. I was like, what did y'all ever do? Like, I couldn't think of one thing. And she said, she looked at me. She goes, hello, the Civil War. I was like, exactly. Look what y'all did. So she's kind of going, well, who is this guy? And so I explained William Barrett Travis to her, and I'm like so proud to be connected to this one who was willing to give his life for the Alamo, for the nation, you know. And so you kind of look at people in your past, and you're like, it's so cool to be related to those kind of people. But notice we don't typically go back in Ancestry.com to figure out who are all the deadbeats we're connected to. Except for maybe you. Most of us don't go, you know, there was this drug lord that I'm connected to. We tend to stick to the William Barrett Travises of the world. We tend to not go down into the negative sense. And so it's kind of, and actually I get it. I mean, like, I started with William Barrett Travis. I didn't start by telling you that I'm the son of a chain-smoking alcoholic who about destroyed my family and my life. That wasn't my opening introduction. But it's woven into my story. It's woven into my family line. And I'm the oldest of five boys, and it was prophesied over us that we would just go the way that my dad went. We'd have five, my mom would have five addicts if she didn't leave her husband. She had a choice to make. Like, that's what's woven into our story. And it, honestly, my story was pretty embarrassing because I grew up going to a small private school where everybody had it all together except me. And if that's part of your family, if you carried that weight of your past, then if you've ever experienced that, you know that kind of cloak that it puts on you. And now my family, we're blessed to be able to do prison ministry. I've never in 2 years of doing this met an inmate that said, I'm so proud of the lineage I come from. And more than anything, they're scared to death about the trajectory of their descendants to come. And it's their greatest weight. This family line thing seems to be an important thing. Again, if you're new to church and Christmas, here's what's so big about this, is that God, in the first part of the book, promised a deliverer was coming in the second part of the book. And he gave them signs to look for. He didn't say, there's a good guy coming. If he does good things, stick with him. He backs himself into a corner. And he goes, he's going to be born from this really tiny town called Bethlehem. He's going to be born from a virgin. And he's going to come down the family line of King David. So if this guy comes and he's from the family line of David, he's from Bethlehem, but it's not from a virgin, he's not your guy. If it's from a virgin, but not the other two, it's like, wow, that's miraculous. He's still not our guy. Because he's got to do all of those things. And so this text you just read points to a couple of them. And the story we're going to read is not typically read around Christmas time, but it actually is a perfect setup to launch us into the Advent season. And it's the story of Ruth. And if you don't know much about the story of Ruth, just read the first verse. You get all that you need. Verse 1 says, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn. So it says, in the days of judges. Now, the book before Ruth, anybody know what it's called? Good job. Y'all are really smart. So Judges, and if you've never read Judges, I'll explain the whole thing. Here it is. God really loves his people. They are unfaithful to him. And so he can, just like Lindsay just shared, he has to pull his hands back, and they end up being judged by being overtaken in multiple ways. They can't take it anymore, and they cry out for a deliverer. God raises up a deliverer, somebody like Samson, Deborah. And then they have peace until that deliverer dies. And then they repeat the process. And that's over and over and over all throughout the book of Judges, actually all throughout the scriptures. You see the same exact story. So it seems right here that it says there was a famine in the land. So a lot of historians have projected that there is a famine in Bethlehem. Anybody know what the word Bethlehem means? Who said that? House of what? House of bread or house of food. That's exactly right. So the house of bread is experiencing a famine. That's why a lot of historians are saying, then it must be that in the days of Ruth, they are going through one of those cycles and they're going through judgment. We see this in Deuteronomy chapter 11. This is where the law of Moses is given and explains what would happen. It says, take care lest your heart be deceived and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you. He will shut up the heaven so that there will be no rain. The land will yield no fruit. You will perish quickly off the good land that the Lord has given you. So the house of bread is going through a famine, and this is where we find ourselves right there in Bethlehem. And so they have to get out. Sojourn means get out. And so it says here, in the country of Moab, this is the rest of verse 1, and he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Epaphrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab, and they remained there. Now, at first glance, that's just a bunch of historical details, but it's just told you they're going into the land of Moab. 100 miles south, one level makes sense. They've got food there. Let's just go there. Pretty easy to get to. No big deal. Except the Moabites have a dangerous history. And it does not make sense that he went there. Actually, I don't understand. You have to ask yourself, what would make him go there? Because their history doesn't start good. This is actually not PG type stuff. Genesis 19 says where they arrived from. Verse 36, thus both the daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He's the father of the Moabites to this day. Their start and beginning is in incest. Not a great way to get your family lineage going. And that's where they are. And God has strong feelings about what would happen with these people, the Moabites. You see it in Isaiah. This is not the part of the Christmas story. We read Isaiah 9. Go a little further to Isaiah 25. For the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain. Moab shall be trampled down in his place as straw is trampled down in a dunghill. He's equating the Moabites to poop. And he's like, you, this is like canonized forever. How would you like it? Your lineage canonized forever for millennia as poop. That is it. And others will do the same. If you go to Psalms, you go to Amos, you see the same thing written about these people called the Moabites. So what in the world are these Moabites doing that is so bad? Like, are they just being held accountable for what this man Lot did? What you do if you do some history digging is you find out that they had a god. Their god was named Chemosh. And Chemosh required them to sacrifice their babies to him to appease his anger. And God is like, I want nothing to do with the slaughter of these babies. And if you start to go their ways, there's lots of other things that could happen. And you could intermarry, therefore you'd intermingle, and your DNA would become the evil that these people walk in. And so he puts it pretty strong boundaries. Deuteronomy says, no Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord even to the 10th generation. None of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever. So the Moabites are a cursed people, and the curse is clear. You can't enter into the assembly of the Lord. Like, you can't just walk in the doors and come to church. And if you've been shut out in that way, you've been shut out from redemption. You've got no shot. So what's it take to get a guy, take his family and say, I know where we're going? Moab. What kind of desperation do you have to be in to say, that's where we're going? So it seems like he sets them up with a place that's got lots of food, but he's going to put them in spiritual jeopardy by taking them there. And so, verse 3 says, Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. She was left with her two sons. They took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah. The name of the other was Ruth. So they go there, and it gets worse because the man who took them there died. It even gets worse than that in that they did the greatest fear. They've intermarried with these cursed foreigners. And now Orpah and Ruth, these cursed sinners, are now brought into the family. I wish I could say that that's as bad as it gets, but then it gets worse. Verse 4 and 5. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died. So the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Do y'all just feel the Christmas spirit brewing? You just feel it, can't you? Just want to pass some hot chocolate, light a candle, sing Silent Night. You feel it? Again, you don't find hope by looking for hope. You find hope by going to the hopeless place. You go back to Moab, and you find some people that are relating to you right about now. This, how in the world could this be the beginning of the Christmas story? After all, this is 1,300 years before a little baby named Jesus would be born. But we're about to find out that he's still going to visit his people no matter what. Verse 6. Then Naomi arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab. She had heard in the fields of Moab, meaning she's out there trying to find food, that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. And then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. I mean, what kind of woman must this lady Naomi must have been that her daughters-in-law, they're weeping over the fact that they might be separated. This is unbelievable. I mean, first of all, it's unbelievable because you're dealing with a Moabite, women that are weeping over this Israelite woman. But just in general, the daughter-in-law, mother-in-law relationships typically kind of complex. So what do you have to do to be in the situation where you're weeping over the departure of your mother-in-law? And you're cursed and she's blessed and all those things are playing into the dynamic. This is a little deeper than, I don't like that she brings sweet potatoes with pecans instead of marshmallows. Like, this is a little bit of a deeper scenario that's going on here. But Naomi's wise. She's going, listen. The plight of widows today is so different than it was back then, especially since women were uneducated. Many of them did not work. Widows, their plight was destitution. She knows that. She's going, listen, you got a hard shot remarrying here in your homeland, much less if you come home with me to my homeland. Go back to your people, your gods. Go get married. Start over. It's your only hope. Verse 14. They lifted up their voices, they wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. this is kind of like if you're a parent, your kids have ever grabbed your leg and you're like going like this, like she can't go anywhere. Ruth is like on her leg and she's then going to say the words that unbeknownst to her would be read at every wedding in the history of the world after that moment. In verse 16, it says, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I'll go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death departs me from you." Did y'all hear that? Your God, Naomi, is now my God. She's walking away from Chemosh and her ways and her heritage and her land and her traditions, where she has friends and relatives and she's known, and she's like, I'm willing to go into the unknown and I'm willing to follow Elohim, Yahweh, Jehovah. I'm going to follow you. How that's possible is unbelievable. But I want you to notice instead what happened once they make the 100-mile trek and they find themselves landing back in Bethlehem. Verse 19 says, "The two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred." Why are they stirred? The women said, "Is this Naomi?" So they could be just stirred like, she's back, and we're just so glad to see our friend. So Naomi returned, verse 22 says, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. So it probably isn't just because she's coming back. It's because she's coming back with a cursed foreigner. She's coming back with someone that nobody could understand. This would be, if you were alive at 9/11 or studied it, the response to people from Afghanistan and anybody wearing any kind of head covering on 9/12 and 9/13 was not receptive. So imagine 9/12, you show back up and you've got this lady here, and she's wearing her hijab, she's wearing her covering, or maybe the burqa, and only you see her eyes, and you're like, no, I'm telling you, she's a good one. Do you think the people in America are like, oh, great, well, welcome? No, absolutely not. Some of you probably felt that sting. That's what it's like for her to bring this woman back. And she doesn't bring her back to the metroplex. She doesn't bring her back to a big city. Bethlehem just got a couple hundred people at the time, which is why it doesn't make sense. Like, even if you were like to say the Messiah is going to be born in Arkansas, you'd probably go, where? Like Hot Springs or Little Rock, maybe Fayetteville. It's like, no, Farmington. Excuse me, what? Right? You'd just be like, you'd think it'd be a little bit different, right? Like, this is not making sense. The Bible doesn't seem to be making sense here. And now we see Ruth's plight, but God's about to take you into Naomi's soul. Because this is, I think, what is really important to see. Verse 20 says, she said to her friends who've come to greet her, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Lord Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full. The Lord's brought me back empty. So don't call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me." I mean, how can you blame her? She's lost a husband. She's lost two sons. Now a daughter-in-law. She's like, I'm just going to change my name. My name is no longer Naomi. My name is Mara. That means bitter. So every time I hear my name, I'll just remember my circumstances. What if you changed your name at the worst circumstance you've ever had? What if when my baby brother Jeff died at age 20, I changed my name to somehow mean death? That's what she's doing. What if in the middle of my mom walking out of my dad for the next 13 months and we wondered if divorce was imminent, we just, whatever name is closest to divorce and addiction and destruction, that's what you called me. Not Carl, which y'all know what that means, right? Strong and manly. Y'all all knew that, right? So like y'all, you were like, no, we're not going to call him that. We're going to call him strong. And like, you don't even have to say Carl. You say strong and manly, because that's what comes naturally, rolls off the tongue when you see me. I get it. I totally get it. But she's changing her name to mean bitter. She goes on another place and she says the phrase, "The hand of the Lord is against me." Before we judge her, anybody else ever felt that? like, keep praying, keep spending time with God and go to life group and do the membership class. It doesn't feel like everything in my life is working out still. It's not just flowing and I don't know what's going on, meaning the pain I'm experiencing, what's going on all around me must have something to do with the fact that God's distanced himself from me. I don't know what I've done. And she's taking it on herself. And again, you probably had that experience. You felt that way. And like I mentioned, my wife and I and my kids, we've been able to do some prison ministry. And the first time I went was kind of eye-opening. The second time I went changed my life. So the third time I went, I needed Blair to come with me. I was like, you've got to experience this. Well, we walked into the prison. It's a women's prison. There's like 60 women in this 18-month course, basically, where they're trying to kind of better themselves and walk in faith, whatever their faith is. And so we walked into the library, got there a little early, and there's these five or six ladies milling around. And I meet the first one. She says her name is Irma, and then Blair's behind me, and she's like, hi, Irma. My name is Blair. And I said, Irma, what are you working on? And she said, well, we have for class tonight, we have to write our whole life story. I was like, that's a big project. I don't know why, but she looked right past me, right at Blair, and said, would you like to read my family? Would you like to read my life story? And Blair said I'd be honored, and I just kept going down the line, and I'm talking to these other ladies. So we go through the night. It's just kind of a normal night, you know, walk to teaching, talk about it in small groups. Revival didn't break out, you know, we just fist bump them and they leave. We go back home and we're processing it a little bit. And Blair says, Carl, it was something, I might botch the details a little bit, but along the lines of like, you know, she's basically raised in a bar. At 10 years old, she's molested. At 12 years old, she's doing drugs. At 14 years old, she's prostitute, getting pimped out. By the age of 30, I think she was a grandmother. To hear Irma's story, you would never go, I wonder how she's in prison. The dots all line up. But what did not line up was that night they did worship as well. They don't have a worship team like this. The worship team they use is people who are like, they do sign language. Even though there's no one really deaf, they do it as a way of like interacting with the words and with God. And that night, Irma was on the worship team, and she came up, and she was one of the six or seven ladies who were doing the signs as they were singing a song that I bet a lot of you have heard. It's from Bethel. It's called The Goodness of God. If you don't know it, it goes like this. All my life you have been faithful, and all my life you have been. See, y'all know it too. And Blair just kind of paused, and she just said, if there's ever a group of women in the history of the world who could say that all my life he was not faithful, it's them. And yet they're singing, with every breath that I am able, oh, I will sing of the goodness of God. It was stunning. Because when I like have had multiple appliances go out in my life, I'm like halfway to atheism. You know what I mean? Like the washer, the dryer, and Mackenzie's needs new tires. Is there a God? I think we got a picture of Irma. This is Irma with my wife, my other daughter, Mary Kate. The night I'm talking to you about, the leader walked up, put her arm around this 5 foot nothing woman and said, this is the meanest prisoner I've ever met in my 15 years. I was like, Irma? He's like, don't you love that you can't see that? You look in those eyes and see hopelessness? She didn't get hope because I gave her a message about hope. She got hope because she was intersected by something much deeper. That's what we're about to find in Ruth's story. Verse 2 says that Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, would you let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor? She said to her, go, my daughter. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. Now, it says here, can I just go into someone's field? Again, that might make sense at first glance. Can you imagine, like, if we were like, hey, can y'all just go over to Farmington, just walk into fields and just start taking everybody's stuff and bring it back? I don't know how y'all do things in Arkansas. In Texas, we paint our T-post in purple, and that means you come over here, we can shoot you. But in Leviticus chapter 23, did y'all read that this morning in your time with God? No? Okay, let me recap. Leviticus 23 says this, that God did not want anyone who owned a field to harvest the whole thing, but to leave the corner so if any alien or stranger or foreigner came through, they would experience mercy and grace by having food. So she's going to go to the corners and see if she can find anything that she, as the widow, and her mother-in-law, who's the widow, can eat. And so she goes to, she's going to go to this field, and we find out whose field she goes into is Boaz's. But this is a big risk. She's a single woman, and she's going into a field most likely worked by men. Verse 22, and Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It's good, my daughter, that you go with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So basically it's like, if you stay home, we starve. If you go out there, you could be assaulted. This is her plight. And she's like, well, I guess I'll just go for that field. I'll jump the fence with the purple paint, and I'll just kind of hope for the best. Verse 4, behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." So the fact that he's just said, "The Lord be with you," indicates he's not going the way the rest of the whole people are going. They're distancing themselves from God. He doesn't seem to be this way. And he comes up, and he goes to the workers, and he's like, "Who's that girl?" A question that every man in this room has asked at least one point or another. Like, who's that one? And they're like, well, she is the hardest worker. She's the one with Naomi, and kind of tells the story. So he goes over to her, and he's just like, listen, all the food you want, it's yours. The Gatorade, it's all yours. The guys aren't going to hurt you. You take whatever you want. He goes to the guys and says, drop extra for her. And that's like, wow. It's like, okay. She doesn't know what to do with it. Verse 10, she says, she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said, "Why have I found favor in your eyes?" Good question. "That you would take notice of me? I'm a foreigner. I'm wearing my burqa on 9/12. Why are you being so kind to me?" Verse 11, Boaz answers her, "All that you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, it's been told to me. How you left your father and mother, native land, came to people you didn't know before. So the Lord will pay you for what you've done. A full reward given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." He knows she switched gods. But still, she's asking a good question. Why would you show favor to me? Nope, kind of like nobody else is. The people at HEB weren't moving their cart, letting me sweep up to the front. Like, why? Why? This is a great question that she's asking. It's a great question we should ask. And all you have to do is just do a little bit more history and digging into Boaz, and you might get your answer. Because what we know about Boaz is his dad was named Salmon. Everybody say Salmon. Like the fish you eat. Okay? Now, that was his dad. Some scholars believe that when the spies were sent into Jericho to go see if they could take it, some scholars believe that that he was one of those. We don't know for certain. What we know is they stayed in the house of a prostitute named Rahab. It would make sense that men were kind of going in and out of there. They went in there to hide. We don't know if Salmon was one of those spies. What we know is that after they ransacked the city, they spared Rahab. They let her live. And Salmon married Rahab. They had a son named Boaz. If anybody knows what it's like to have a mom go from the city prostitute to being brought into Israelite royalty and know how grace can change everything, it would be Boaz. It would make sense that he would be like, just drop more food. Take care of her. He knows what it's like to experience grace, and he's making sure that his crew is going to give grace to her. And so they start to drop all this food left and right. And then verse 20 says, and Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed of the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." That's like Israelite speak for, what bank did you rob to get all this food? How did you get all this? And then when she hears it's Boaz, she's like, oh, she makes another interesting statement. The rest of verse 20, what does she say? Let's read the last part. Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours. He's one of our redeemers." Now, Ruth probably was like, he's one of our what? And some of you might be that way. Like, what does that mean? I thought we sang that about Jesus. Your version may actually use a different word. It may say kinsman redeemer. Again, we don't use this language and we don't have this philosophy in our day and age. But if you were a kinsman redeemer in these days, you had four different kind of responsibilities or opportunities. It's kind of wild to think about, but let's take a look. So basically, a kinsman redeemer is either a brother, an uncle, a cousin, someone in the family line. And you could step in and you could protect an impoverished family if they were like up to debt in their eyeballs or something. And you could step in and you could help pay that off. Or if they had lost property, either because they were in debt or they had been stupid or careless in their money, you could buy that property back. Because if not, it was legal that if you could not pay off your bills and your note, then someone could take you as a slave. So they could actually redeem you from slavery. Now, none of those three, though, is where Ruth finds herself. She's wrapped up in number four, where an heir can be given for male relatives. Now, this is strange. Like I said, I've got a few brothers. If I die, I don't want any of them to marry Blair. That's just weird. But again, in those days, in that day and age, being a widow was much different. And so this was God's mercy to have someone step in and marry you and in a moment to take you from either destitute or indebted or enslaved or without a family line, and now your family line could be preserved. Really kind of a wild thought that this could happen. So Naomi knows this, and she's like, go, Ruth, go take a shower. Go put on perfume, whatever you've got. You get back to that field right away. And then she gives her the instructions. I'm sure y'all all would have done the same thing. In verse 4, it says, and when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he'll tell you what to do. I mean, that's just creepy weird. Can you just imagine? Don't you know Ruth is like taking notes going, he lays down, and then you lie down, and then you just put your foot under the blanket. He'll tell you what to do. I mean, this is just, she's like, these people are on drugs. That's what I would say. It's not what she says. What does she say in verse 5? All that you say, I will do. It's wild. But it's kind of prophetic, because about 1,300 years later, an angel would appear to another woman in Bethlehem and tell her that though she's a virgin, she's going to have a child, and he'll be called the Son of God. And I would have thought that angel is on drugs. And that woman would say, all that's in your heart, I will do. It's wild what's happening in the house of bread, what's happening in this place called Bethlehem. Verse 7 says that it happened just like Naomi said. Boaz has eaten and drunk. His heart was merry. He went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly, covered his feet, and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over. And behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, who are you? That's a great question. It's a great question. We're staying at a hotel. And for Blair thought she was waking me up a lot last night by moving around. She wasn't. I was out. So she moved and went to Mackenzie's bed. I told Mackenzie, I was like, so how'd it go waking up to mom? And she's like, at first I was like, who's in my bed? I really hope it's mom. You know, like, we're just in the same hotel room. This is like, he's waking up in a strange woman, which all women have cold toes. I don't know if you know that. They all have cold toes. This is how all marriages go downhill, is they put those freaking cold toes on us. And we're like, wear socks, but they don't do it. And they refuse to do it. God knows he wakes her up with those cold toes. He's woken up by these cold toes. And she answers, I'm Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. Now listen to this response. He says, whew, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. He's using words daughter, young, which scholars kind of guesstimate that Ruth would have been about 20 or 25 years old. He's not going to use words like young or daughter unless he's older. So he's filled with so much integrity. He's like, I would never come near you. And she's basically like, I know. So since you wouldn't come to me, I'm basically making the first move to say, if you'd be interested, here's my number. I'll do coffee if you're up for it. So she's putting herself out there in the most integrity-filled way that she can. So that's why if your mom was ever like, go be Ruth, she was basically like, go stick your foot under someone's blanket and let's see if this thing will work out. So the problem is, when he hears this, he goes, here's the deal. There's actually a kinsman redeemer closer in the family line. I can't redeem you. He gets first dibs. So he gets the field that your mother-in-law owns and you if he wants that. So he goes to the kinsman redeemer and he's like, hey, there's a field. Do you want it? And he's like, oh, I absolutely want it. And he's like, okay, if you take the field, there's one other thing that comes with it. And what he does next is just brilliant. I mean, if you've ever not wanted to do something, and you painted the worst picture in the history of the world. He's about to paint the worst picture in the world of this woman and what he's going to have to do. So verse 5, he goes, then Boaz said, okay, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead. I mean, not like she's so beautiful, hard worker. We've seen a lot in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. It's interesting. The Redeemer goes, I can't redeem it. I just can't do it. Lest I'll impair my own and take my right of redemption. I can't redeem it. And so he does. So Boaz gets on one knee. He marries Ruth. They throw a great big celebration. And what's wild is that at the celebration, more than they honor Ruth, they honor Naomi. Verse 13, Boaz took Ruth. She became his wife. He went into her and the Lord gave her conception and she bore a son. And the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. Blessed are you, Mara Bitter, who correlated your circumstances to your own personal hope. Blessed are you, because the Lord has given you a redeemer. And while you thought you had nothing left of hope in the world, I actually see something completely different. And here's how he's gonna start bringing some healing. They have a child. What's the name of the child of Boaz and Ruth? Well, it's even interesting to learn who named him. Verse 17 of chapter 4 says, the women of the neighborhood gave him a name. I mean, just if you can't come up with one, ask your neighbors. Warning, they'll say something like, a son has been born to Naomi, and they named him Obed. So be careful. You give them rights, they will come up with weird stuff. And they name him Obed, who was the father of Jesse, who's the father of David. And now we're right back to our family line that God had promised a redeemer would come through. What's all that about? What's wild is that Ruth, the widow, the cursed foreigner, who was in her place of absolute destitution, would become the great grandmother of King David. Besides Mary, there's only four women in the whole genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1. She's in there. It leads right to Matthew chapter 1, verse 16. Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called the Christ. How does a cursed Moabite get into the family line of the pure and holy Messiah, Jesus? Answer, there had to be a redeemer. And the word redeem means to obtain at a high price. And in the same way that Boaz redeemed at a high price this woman, Ruth, it would be the prophetic picture of a young man who would be born of a virgin in the city of Bethlehem, down the family line of King David, who would obtain you at a high price by living a life of perfection, taking your sin, your mess, your family lineage, and all the junk that comes with that, putting it on himself, and then dying until all that death died, and then coming back to life so that you had a chance to experience new life and could do a candlelight service and sing Silent Night, Holy Night. All of that started in the midst of all this mess. It's wild to me. The storyline of Jesus, it doesn't start with William Barrett Travis's. and John Wayne's. It goes back and makes sure that all these jacked up people are right in the middle of the family line. Why does God do that? Why does God make sure that the family lineage is so jacked up? Why is it not like the days of old where royalty, you know, we can't have you marrying my daughter because she's going to be a queen, so I need royal blood. And they make sure that royalty marries royalty to make sure that there's royalty, make sure there's royalty. And Jesus is like, no, you know who I'm looking for? The broken and the moral disasters. The people who are headed towards destitution. The people who have no hope. That's who I want. And then he makes sure that he comes right down the line. And what does Naomi end up being? The great-great-grandmother of King David? She didn't see that coming. 25 pregnancies later, here comes King Jesus. And now we find ourselves in a manger, and there can only be one reason for this, is that the family line Jesus came from indicates the family line he's coming for. Because the family line he came from is a bunch of jacked-up people who don't deserve a spot in the kingdom. And he made sure you knew that family line was coming because he was going to invite you and your family into it. Because I don't know about you, but let me just tell you my story. My story I already told you, by the way. It's the judge's story. He loved me, but I was unfaithful to him and found myself in a life of bondage that I deserved. And I just called out to his mercy that he would please rescue and save me from it. And he did. And he was that deliverer that came for me and has offered me a life out. And when that woman, when those people told my mom that if she would divorce her husband, she would have a hope at having 5 sons who could actually make it out, one woman spoke up and came to my mom and said, you can do that if you want. You probably have the grounds to do so. But if you'll stay, you'll have an inheritance and sons who will go into ministry and serve God. And while they separated for a while, they got back together, and there was a time when all of my brothers were in ministry together. That line did not make sense. That line did not, we did not see it. We had called ourselves Mara, bitter, embarrassed. But God had a different plan. That's what he does. You can't find hope, though, for your finances right now by just going and finding a hope verse and yelling that in the mirror every morning until your finances change. You can go do that, but I can't guarantee you your circumstances are going to change or that you'll feel any better. But like Lindsay said, hope's found in a person, and it's come by looking backwards at the trajectory of a faithful God who, when you were not faithful, he kept pursuing you and pursuing you and pursuing you. And it backs up millennia back to a woman named Ruth, a man named Boaz, that would find its way right into the manger so that we could all say Merry Christmas. That's your story, and that's where your hope comes from. And as we wrap up our time, I just want to ask everybody just to close your eyes for a moment. And our worship team's going to come, and I want you just to sit. I've talked a lot. I just want us to sit in that space wherever you would be tempted to name yourself Mara. Maybe it's a relationship that just won't go right. Maybe it's the feeling that, why do you always do something wrong? Maybe it's that I don't know why I don't experience God's presence the way that others do. Maybe it's I've taken some hits in life. I didn't see it being playing out this way. And I can't guarantee you that if we pray over you this morning, all that's going to change, on this side of heaven at least. But I think the invitation for you today is to recognize that the intersection of a redeemer in your story is the birth of all hope. Because your kinsman redeemer saw that you were impoverished, had lost what you once had, had become a slave to sin, and stepped in to become married to you, to adopt you, and to invite you into a family. And Lord, that's where we find our hope. And so we reach out this morning and we grab a hold of you.
and we thank you for being that Redeemer.